Hello and welcome to the Mixed Media Podcast for Wednesday, June 10th. I'm Chris Wagner, culture critic for the Dallas Morning News, and I'm joined in the studio, as always, by Christopher Wynn, deputy editor for FD, the style magazine of the Dallas Morning News. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Chris.
Also joining us, as always, is Lauren Smart, arts and culture editor for the Dallas Observer. Hello, Lauren.
Hello.
On today's program, Dallas Morning News restaurant critic Leslie Brenner and Aldea managing editor Alfredo Carbajal join us to talk about producing the paper's first ever completely bilingual interactive about the rise of a new wave of Mexican cuisine in Dallas. Next, Dallas Morning News architecture critic Mark Lampster is back to talk NBA finals and televised sports as overproduced entertainment. And finally, we check in on Jurassic World, the fourth chapter of the dinosaur franchise, looks to chomp and snort its way to box office domination this weekend. But is it any good? Let's get started. Se muele con cacahuate. Se muele también el pan. Se muele la almendra seca. Se muele el chile y también la sal. Leslie Brenner is the restaurant critic and dining editor for the Dallas Morning News. Her new story is about the rise of so-called New Wave Mexican cuisine in Dallas as local chefs and restaurateurs look to Mexico for creative inspiration. She's partnered on the piece with Alfredo Carbajal, managing editor of Aldea, Texas's largest Spanish-language daily newspaper, to create the paper's first completely bilingual interactive. Hello, Leslie. Hello, Alfredo. Let's talk Mexican food.
Hello.
Hello, let's do. I have a question. What is New Wave Mexican cuisine?
Well, the story's about a couple things going on at the same time in and around Dallas around Mexican cooking. And one is that this thing that I call modern Mexican cuisine has really caught the imagination of a bunch of local chefs and restaurateurs. And, you know, it's the kind of thing that, you know, you might find at an upscale restaurant in Mexico City, but it's happening a lot right now here in Dallas, and it's something that started happening around 2011. We saw a lot of it, and a whole bunch of interesting restaurants opened that year, and then in the following couple years. In the interim, a bunch also closed, but there's still some going strong, and very recently, just in the last 4 months or so, I think five or six new places have opened up. So that's very exciting. And at the same time, there's some really interesting serious regional cooking going on as well. So that's sort of this next wave of the next wave.
And what kind of dishes might we look for in new wave Mexican cuisine? And where might we get them?
Well, there's a place really the place that's sort of most on the out there edge of it is called Le Taco Cantina, and it's on Oak Lawn, and it's in a space that used to be Scotch and Sausage.
Talk about it. when that went up and I saw that sign, I was just like...
Scotch and Sausage?
Yes.
Oh, Lord. Yeah. I could have done some damage there back in the day.
Exactly.
So,
it
yeah.
It didn't last very long.
It was only open for just about 6 months, something like
or
that?
Or 6 minutes, or yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
I actually thought it was sort of a fun idea, but it didn't work. So now the chef is called, it's the same owner. The chef is Daniel Tarasevich, and he's doing he loves Mexican street food, specifically Mexico City street food. And so he's doing these really kind of wacky global takes on it, like with, one has, I think he's calling it smoked duck confit. It's a smoked duck confit taco with like hoisin sauce and shredded cabbage, and you know, so it has sort of Asian flavors and French technique. I had a special there recently that had tempura'd soft shell crab and eel with eel sauce and a hit of wasabi, and you know, so really kind of out there stuff, and also some things that are closer to to traditional Mexican cooking. Like he had a really nice carnitas taco, but with some more kind of global touches. So that's kind of at one end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. And then there's a new restaurant called El Bolero from the people who own Oak and Pac Pau, mm-hmm. and it's in the Design District, and they're doing just sort of, you know, updated, very fresh takes on some regional dishes with some very modern touches, like they're doing lobster fajitas, nice. Whatever that means, and a whole bunch of different ceviches with really fresh, bright flavors.
So when I've eaten at both of those restaurants recently, I just assumed the chef was like lost in what he was doing. But maybe the cosmopolitan approach is intentional?
You thought he just like threw some stuff together.
I was like, oh, this is like an Asian taco, street Mexican street taco. But this is very much something that is happening in other places too.
Well, I think at that place it's very purposeful and he's riffing and having fun and doing something purposely global, and that's why it's called Le Taco Cantina. Mm-hmm. I don't really think that at any of the other places that we're seeing right now, none of them have gone quite as global as that.
Mm-hmm. Alfredo, what can you tell us about this package and Aldea's participation in it, and also just whatever input you have on this subject?
Well, before talking about the package and the stories and the journalism, I think one of the things that are happening, and Leslie and I talked about this last week and the week before that, it was I see a trend of restaurants with what people call modern Mexican food or traditional food, kind of trying to strip away any hints of Tex-Mex. And everybody here is very, very proud of Tex-Mex, and it's part of the tradition in Dallas. But, you know, the menu, you go in to the restaurant and look at the menu, and you hardly see some of those elements there. That's my experience. I'm not a restaurant critic, so that's just my personal experience. It's lively. It's really a new environment, and I think it's pretty inviting for a lot of people, especially the ones that want to reclaim traditional Mexican food. Now, talking about the...
Can I just add something there to what you're saying? I mean, because an example would be like if some of these restaurants, instead of queso, where you would see the processed cheese,
right,
that you would see queso fundido.
Queso Oaxaca.
Exactly.
Some of the traditional ingredients from Mexico. And you know, it's becoming a lot more popular, actually. People are getting even used to how to say it, how to pronounce it, how to order it.
Does Tex-Mex have a stigma? Is that something that...
I want to say Leslie described in her story Tex-Mex as Americanized melted cheese blanketed dishes.
Oh, it's so delicious.
But I think that's a great question for Alfredo, if it has a stigma.
I think different segments of the population here may feel differently about Tex-Mex. Tex-Mex is as Dallas as you could be. It's native Dallas. And once in a while, it's great to go out and get some really good Tex-Mex. And there are great places here in Dallas for great Tex-Mex. But what we're seeing here, it's as populations continues to change, especially with all the influx of middle class, professional class from Mexico who are relocating to Dallas, they want to go back to some of the traditional restaurants, and they want to experience what they experience in traditional restaurants, like in places like Mexico City, in La Condesa and Polanco, all of those places, very fancy, informal, yet informal places where there's traditional Mexican food. So I think Tex-Mex is not that it has a bad reputation. It has a place, but now we're seeing something that probably it was not a trend, at least in the last 15 years. I guess the one disclaimer that I'll say is there's always been traditional Mexican food in Dallas, but mainly in small restaurants, kind of homemade Mexican food. Now what we see is these restaurants opening up in some trendy areas and kind of following the diversification of Dallas, especially in downtown Dallas.
I found that it's very difficult, in my experience anyway, to eat semi-healthy at Tex-Mex. It almost seemed like a hangover sop kind of thing, just so rich.
That's what's so good about it.
And don't get me wrong, I love
and the point.
I love some queso, and I love chalupas and all of that. But it seems like some of this stuff you could actually go and intentionally eat healthy.
Yeah, I mean, especially with all these, you know, a lot of these places have wide selections of ceviches and really creative ones. And I mean, that's like totally clean, healthy, you know, feel good food as opposed to comfort food.
Well, and Alfredo, you mentioned that a lot of the people, they're looking for the experience they had in Mexico. Is that one of the reasons you thought this is a feature we need to make bilingual?
Well, actually, we were in the same meeting when Leslie mentioned about the project, and it just kind of dawned on me that since this is Mexican food, talking about a new trend, and in Dallas where we see, you know, the influence of a lot of Mexicans coming to live here, I thought that maybe this is one of those opportunities where we could do this bilingual. And especially on the digital production, anybody in the world can just read it. So I think it's really cool components. The glossary, I like the glossary a lot because Leslie.
What are some examples on the just menu items and you know?
Yeah, it's
food
like what
terms.
what is wheat la coche or what is?
Oh, that's an easy one.
What is a trompo?
Yeah,
please, you need a glossary for that.
Well, here's the thing, and
I don't know.
And
yeah.
We have a team of editors and copywriters from Aldea, the Spanish paper, that they're really good and they're native Spanish speakers, that they were helping us with the spelling and the proper pronunciation and the meaning of that. But since we have people from different parts of the world or different places in the Americas, some of them, they did not know some of those terms. So I thought it was a really good idea for everybody, regardless if they're Spanish speakers or not, to be exposed to, again, all of those terms and ingredients. And it was a fun experience.
It seems like we've reached a point, too, where almost anything can be called a taco. If it has
That's
some
true.
Kind of shell or bread and some kind of exotic innards.
Yeah, and even maybe not a shell or bread, because some of these tacos actually at La Taco Cantina and at Velvet Taco also, you can get a taco that's just wrapped in a lettuce leaf rather than a tortilla.
The Atkins taco.
Exactly.
I mean, what makes something a taco?
Ooh, that's like a philosophical question.
We could be here for hours on that one. Alfredo, what do you think makes something a taco? Any thoughts?
Well, the simplest explanation I can come out with, it involves a tortilla. That's somehow, right?
I can roll with
but,
that.
But over here in downtown Dallas, there are a lot of food trucks selling Korean tacos.
Like kimchi
right.
tacos?
Yeah,
yeah something
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
And they're delicious, by the way.
And maybe that's what I was saying earlier about the La Taco Cantina. I was like, are you just, I've seen these at food trucks, but it's very different. It's absolutely different.
Well, yeah, I mean the ones that I've had those Korean tacos, and I think that's a fun idea. And you know, it's just a matter of like riffing a little more than that. You know, that's riffing with one, you know, with Korean food and a specifically Korean Mexican fusion, and this other thing is like all kinds of global influence.
What can you guys tell us about the interactive element of this? What makes this interactive? What can people look for on this feature?
Will drone cameras be zooming into plates of delicious?
I hope not. So one of the things that's really cool about this is our brilliant interactive editor, John Hancock, has figured out a way that you'll be able to click on the story and there will be like a toggle switch. And so you'll be able to have all of the material in English or flip the switch and then have it all in Spanish. And that means the main story, and then there will be a timeline, which will be an interactive timeline that you'll click on a date and it'll say what happened in that day with archival photos and stuff. And then there will be like five important things to know about modern Mexican cuisine, and we'll have the glossary, so all kinds. Oh, and a video that's been shot once in Spanish and once in English, so you'll get that both ways. So it really is truly bilingual.
And we have not done that before at the paper, is that right? That's a first?
It's the first time we've ever done a completely bilingual interactive.
It's sort of astonishing to think about that. Actually, I'm glad we're doing it, but
I think it's really fortuitous timing too, because it seems like this is something other institutions in the city are really interested in. Make Art with Purpose is launching a bilingual museum guide for the Dallas mm-hmm. Museum of Art, so it's just nice to see so many people paying attention to the fact that there are two languages being spoken in the city.
Yeah, and I think the other component is what I already mentioned, that being on the web, anybody, anywhere in the world can read it. So it's not just about Dallas, the audience that we serve here with the paper, but also people from outside Dallas, outside Texas.
And you can find this package on both Aldea.com, AldeaDallas.com, I'm sorry,
right.
and DallasNews.com, correct?
Right.
That's right.
And it will also run in the guide section of the good old paper, Dallas Morning News.
The print.
Because we like the print. We're all about the print, even though digital is kind of like, you know, going to kill us slowly and painfully over the next few years.
But maybe not with packages like this.
Exactly.
Yeah. And podcasts like this.
That's right.
Keep
right.
a good thought there. Alfredo Carbajal, Leslie Brenner, thank you so much for joining us and talking the new wave Mexican cuisine.
Thank you for Thank having you. Us. Mexican Institute of STEM.
The NBA Finals are upon us. That might not mean much if you're a basketball agnostic, but the annual shootout has resonance off the court as well. For our purposes, it gives us a chance to consider sports' place in the entertainment industrial complex. Joining us to discuss is Dallas Morning News architecture critic and long-suffering New York Knicks fan, Mark Lamster. Mark, welcome to Mixed Media.
Nice to be back.
Mark, you're our first repeat guest, by the way. Big honor.
You win nothing for that, by the way.
Yes, and that would go in with the Knicks theme.
So no, there you go. So there's a couple of ways we can go with this. This was my idea, so I guess I should lead it off. I have long been fascinated by how events such as the NBA Finals, I guess the Super Bowl is the more common example, get packaged for television, how they sell the drama, how they tie into various movies and other products, how it just becomes part of the entertainment machine. And I thought that would be a good place to start. For instance, during these finals, Pixels is coming out, the video game movie, and they keep showing this ad where Anthony Davis of the Pelicans keeps killing video game villains. He dunks on Centipede. He throws a basketball at Donkey Kong. So you know,
last night he got Pac-Man.
Yeah. Oh, did he really?
I think so.
Oh
yes.
Man, I missed that. So they really are. I wonder if Galaga will be coming up next. So there's this very, you know,
should see what he does with Pong.
I know, man. He's a beast.
Frogger.
He's a beast at table tennis. So yeah, this seems to be very much a part of these events as we know them now.
Well, I think that speaks to our entire culture where everything is consumerized and marketed. Maybe we can look to Michael Jordan as sort of the king of this when it all started with Nike, Just Do It, Gatorade, Mars Blackman as a sort of a sports figure, an athletic figure entering the cultural pantheon. Or maybe this week we should talk about Bruce, now Caitlyn Jenner, really as one of these crossover athletes coming into the Wheaties box. So yeah, it's been a long time.
Good
That's
point.
The way American culture is.
Is it the shoes? Is it the shoes? It's got to be the shoes.
Money, it's not money, the money, shoes,
money.
Mars.
Money, money, money. Sorry, well, Mars Blackman, my favorite.
I just think it's interesting that we've turned these people. I mean, and we talked about this weeks ago. We were talking about Colossal, the football show. We've turned these athletes, these gladiators. They're the people in centuries ago. They were down in the ring, entertaining the kings and emperors, and now we've got these athletes and we've turned them into celebrities, much like Hollywood celebrities. And I guess the culture of the spokesperson is kind of a little bit of what you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, they're spokespeople, but they're also elevated almost god status,
right,
because of the things that we watch them do on the court.
But I think that's why they're so exceptional, is because we're, in a way, we're so used to watching unbelievably talentless people. And if we're going to talk about the Jenners, I mean, the Kardashians are famous for being famous. And one of the things that's really, really great about televised sports, about professional sports, is that we see genius performed before us by just extraordinary achievement. The players are performing at levels that are just extraordinary. And I think, talking about the NBA this week, and we've seen LeBron James achieve a level of basketball genius. What he's doing is unprecedented. Really, the only precedent, I guess, is Michael Jordan. It's extraordinary. It's extraordinary to watch. And I think that's one of the reasons people turn in. Where else in life can you see someone who's at the absolute apex, of their abilities performing publicly? It's really special.
The packaging has really changed over the years, too. I remember watching in the late 80s, I think it was when the Rockets played the Lakers in the Western Finals. I remember watching that on tape delay at midnight, after midnight, watching that game in. They weren't even live broadcasts. Now, they come equipped with these short films, with the documentary tribute to Stuart Scott, with all of these bells and whistles. And it's gone from not even being shown on live television to being a sharply and very minutely produced production. at this point. I guess that speaks to the growth of the NBA in the last several years as well.
I firmly believe that we're watching the NBA finals right now. The NBA's and other sports are basically the best drama on television, you know, with all respect to Mad Men, in terms of excitement, production values, dynamism, moral, you know, stake, just how entranced the public is with them. There is really, I don't think anything compares to it. There is nothing more compelling. And the production values, of course, are so astronomically great. So many cameras. The lighting is so brilliantly done. It's what's interesting to me is that I think part of the problem with the events is that now the referees have to watch the games on TV because they're so beautifully televised. And that, in fact, is ending up taking some of the humanity out of the game because they have to stop. The end of every game becomes just a series of replay reviews where the referees go and look at the beautiful video footage to see what actually happened, and we lose sort of the humanity and the spontaneity of sport. And it's really kind of ridiculous. I mean, it speaks to this morality that we throw in this, like we've created this drama about who's going to win and who's going to lose, and it's really incredibly important to us. And in a way, it is. But it, you know, it also reminds me of the, you know, the Jerry Seinfeld. You know, we're rooting for laundry. You know, these are corporations playing each other that are part of a bigger, you know, corporation. None of them are particularly friendly to the. In terms of economically to the fan, you're paying out the nose for these,
or to the unions,
right?
The
you
league.
Know, so you know maybe the, but we you know we must get this call right. You know, we're willing to sacrifice entertainment value at some level to get because we're so morally, we have so much moral, you know, of our we're so feel so attached to the moral. So whatever the word is I'm looking for here. It's great right. to fumble with your words on radio. so you can cut that out, right?
Welcome to our world.
So yes. you feel that moral attachment. I feel that moral attachment, but we're both basketball fans. Oh. You guys, I mean, I don't want to make it like a universal thing because this drama that we're talking about in this casting, you know, LeBron James is either Superman or Snidely Whiplash, depending on your perspective. Mm-hmm. It is not across the board.
Well, I would say I'm not a basketball fan. I love sports.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
We can keep talking.
You can keep me in the room. But I will say, and this is something I hadn't really thought about until a few years ago, and it's something super obvious, but sports are so gendered. And I was listening to, I think it was a Chris Boyd Think episode, mm-hmm. and I don't remember, I'm remiss to not remember who her guest was, and he pointed out, you know, the problem with sports is they were created for men's bodies, the body type of a man. And so it's impossible for women on a certain level, people are going to hate me for saying this, but it's impossible for a woman to really compete at that level. So we've created the celebrity machine, right? We've created the celebrity machine that doesn't allow for women to be part of it. And so, and not that that's why I don't watch basketball, because I just don't watch it out with, you know, lack of time and lack of consistent interest. But I do think, I don't know, that's another downside of this machine of sports.
Well, I have a slightly different take on it, which is that we just watched one of the supreme American athletes of the last century, Serena Williams, achieve something completely extraordinary. We're talking about LeBron, we can also talk about Serena. She won her 20th major this last weekend. Mm-hmm. And in the mode of doing it, she had a semifinal match where she basically had the flu, was practically dying on the court.
It's like Jordan against
Utah. She had a Jordan game. She had a Jordan game, which
Steph Curry had a John Starks game.
Right.
Sorry.
But, you know, very little attention paid to her. The New York Times story on the two semifinals that day actually featured a photograph of the other semifinalist that won.
Oh, wow.
And her story was buried, even though it was this monumental accomplishment. And the thing that really, really upset me was I watched with my 9-year-old daughter, you know, and we see this woman accomplish this extraordinary thing. And the immediate commercial that it goes out cuts to is this just horrid, horrid direct TV ad with a swimsuit model.
And a talking horse.
And a talk, it's like a bestiality. Like we go from a woman's supreme achievement to just this, you know, objectified woman, you know, with a horse.
What about objectifying the horse? That's what outrages me.
Okay. Well, that's a whole, you know, okay, we can talk about American Pharoah mm-hmm. in a different sports podcast.
You know,
but so that really offended me. I thought it was offensive.
It's funny, the you know, getting back to the gendering, and I guess we're still on the gendering. I have a friend in New York who I stayed with when I was out there a couple of weeks ago. He is a huge women's softball fan. He's mm-hmm. like, he's buddies with the University of Florida's softball coach. And so I go over there, and every year we watch, because every year they won the last two world championships. Now, every year I watch women's softball with my friend Keith. And I've learned to really appreciate the entertainment value of women's softball. Now, I am predisposed to appreciate the entertainment value of sports in general, but I think it's becoming less gendered with each passing
which
year.
Until you go to a Cowboys game or a Mavs game, and the women play in it is the mid, you know, timeout. They come out with their tits out, and I mean,
not quite there yet.
It really bugs me.
Nice try, Chris.
It really bothers me at the Mavs game also, because I've, you know, Chris and I actually share some season tickets to the Mavericks, and I often take my daughter, and then the Mavs hoochie dancers come out, and I think
that's their official name now.
Yeah, and I don't know, what is that saying to what she can be? And you know, again, but there are these amazing women athletes, and it's great. You know, this is the week of the Women's World Cup, and it's. Or the 2 weeks of the Women's World Cup, and it's an amazing tournament. We just watched the amazing Team USA with this great win, and so I think the way women are covered and women's sports are covered on the one hand, and the way women appear in men's sports are something I think we could all be a little more critical of.
And I don't mean that as any huge disrespect to the women who cheerlead their whole lives, and that truly is an athleticism that I don't possess. But when you talk about how much a Cowboys cheerleader gets paid, they say publicly, these women have to have another job because we don't pay them enough money, and we want to make sure they have other interests because
they
expire after a few years. And that's
as do the players.
But that is also true for the players,
yeah.
Right?
So, Mark, I understand that you have a theory about how Dallas ties in to all of this and how we helped create, the city of Dallas helped create this entertainment industrial sports complex.
Yes. Well, I think if you look back to where the idea of the sports, the televised sport as spectacle, you have to look at the development of Monday Night Football. ABC's Rune Arledge invents Monday Night Football as a spectacle. More cameras, more lights, more guys in the booth being more controversial. And of course, one of the key figures in the booth is Dandy Don Meredith, the happy-go-lucky
Turn
Cowboys.
The lights.
There you go, happy-go-lucky Dallas Cowboy. And then, as you know, not necessarily in the first year, but as Monday Night Football develops, the Cowboys really become the signature franchise, I think you could say, of Monday Night Football, or certainly one of them.
I think the Raiders actually, at their peak, appeared more often than the Cowboys.
But the Cowboys are God's team.
But the Raiders are almost the opposite casting call. They're the bad guys. They're the Pirates.
That's the point, though. It created this compelling narrative with America's team, and then Bad Boys, and you could love them or you could hate them, and it was a spectacle, and the production value is extraordinary. It creates this morality, this narrative, beautifully packaged over time. And obviously, look where the NFL is now. Now, every game is like that, and the NFL is, you know, a gajillion-dollar network, and no matter corporation, and it seems like no matter how badly managed it is, it still keeps doing well.
Well, let's face it, sports don't keep the newspaper afloat by themselves, but they do a pretty good chunk of it. That's what people are going to look to for their fix, usually, first thing.
Well, some people, anyway. I know a lot of people look to the architecture column, actually.
Actually, I've never talked to anybody who looks at that first.
Whoa.
Oh, wait a minute.
Easy.
So, Mark,
Chris is a Golden State Warriors fan coming off a tough loss. So
Mavericks fan first and foremost. But it's all right. You're a Knicks fan, so it's all good.
Lamster was never asked back onto the show.
This feels like my Twitter feed when there's a big game and it just explodes and I have no idea what half the people are talking about.
Speaking of which, next NBA Finals game is Thursday night. I'm sure both Lamster and I will be tweeting, although I'll be at a screening for the first half at least. You can follow Mark Lamster on Twitter at Mark Lamster, MarkLamster. I am at Chris Wagner. We'll go at each other and tell Derek Harper jokes and do all kind of stuff. Watch the NBA Finals. It's good for you. Be right back. Jurassic World is the third sequel to 1993's Jurassic Park. Yes, after all that mayhem, someone still thinks it's a good idea to monkey with dinosaur DNA. Lauren and I saw the movie this week. Christopher was not able to make the screening, but he did download the app. So, we're moving into the movie app territory by accident. But first, let's talk some dinosaurs. So, Lauren, the thing that really struck me was how Spielbergian this felt. He's just the executive producer this time around, but it felt like sort of a junior Spielberg movie to me.
Okay, tell me what you mean by that.
The emphasis on kids and the sanctity of the immediate family, the looming divorce, and how
which
it makes...
Which just gets thrown in.
It does, but that's kind of how...
followed up on.
Kind of how Spielberg rolls.
That was your character development moment.
And, well, and then you have the aunt, who's played by Bryce Dallas Howard, who kind of makes Jurassic World run, and, you know, she doesn't really have time for the kids, and she's kind of the negligent aunt. So it's, you know, it's Spielberg saying, hey, family's important, don't forget that. That's very Spielbergian. The way that some of the dinosaurs are humanized. My favorite scene of the whole movie was when one of the herbivore dinosaurs is dying.
Oh, that's so terribly sad.
And they go, Chris Pratt and Bryce Dallas Howard go and kind of stroke its face.
It was like a scene from, you know, a movie about My Dog Skip or like...
it was heartbreaking.
Yeah.
It's just vegetarian propaganda.
Marley and Me, yeah.
I felt like it was like the beginning of Up. Where you're just like, I'm crying, what's going on?
Yeah.
This isn't supposed to be happening.
Yeah, why am I crying about a
Pixar
dinosaur?
Movie? Yeah, exactly.
So what is the basic premise this go around? How are they, what is the setup for the story?
Well, Chris, they're messing with some dinosaur DNA and they're opening a
not that you need
opening
one, really.
A theme park. So the basic premise, you want to talk about the basic premise?
Sure. More? So it's basically, I mean, for me it felt like almost a repeat of Jurassic Park numero uno. Because it really is the same idea, except for this time, instead of it being a smaller, like almost science-based park, this is about
almost science-based.
this is Jurassic World, and it's this huge international attraction, and
it's like a really well-funded nature and science museum.
Yeah,
with dinosaurs.
Which then you find out
that
later.
Can I
do a spoiler?
Yes.
You find out later that they're like beta testing the dinosaurs to become
militarized
military warriors.
Yes. The military contractor, by the way, the military contractor is the new bad guy of choice in Hollywood. He's also the villain of Aloha, which I don't recommend seeing.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and he's also on an island. He must live on islands, lurk around.
Yes.
Like an evil villain. Well, and I was curious what you thought about this sort of... So we talked earlier in a podcast episode about how this to me is very much like revisiting the conversation that Blackfish started around SeaWorld and this idea that we as human beings are obsessed with taking animals we know can kill us and putting, you know, training them, like proving our dominance over them. And then, of course, there was that thread running through it. And then there was the military, you know, threat of like, we don't have control over these. I mean, it was like kind of felt like drones or some kind of robot army.
I like it when the contractor says, imagine what these puppies could have done in Tora Bora.
Yeah. what was your perspective on the sort of contemporary issues? I mean, do you think that was it was supposed to be politicized.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, I think movies like this, you know, and I think this is a, I should say, I like the film. I don't think it's great, but I thought for what it was trying to do, it did it very well. And yeah, I thought it did a really smart job of weaving these topical elements in and out of the story. And I think it is absolutely intentional. You know, I think blockbusters can be really good vehicles, actually, for making you think about stuff a little bit. You know, and then all we really want is the fun,
right,
in something like this. But if you can give us a tiny bit, just a tiny bit of brain food on the side, that's always nice as well. And when, you know, the non-action, when the movie gets stupid enough, if it can divert us with just the spectacle,
yeah,
then it's working as well. So I thought it worked on both of those counts.
Yeah. And so when I took my sister and we were talking afterwards, and she goes, that was an awfully cheesy movie. And I said, do you remember the original Jurassic Park? Like, do you remember how cheesy that movie was? So I think it keeps kind of that. Like, I thought it's kind of a ridiculous premise, although not that far-fetched, maybe.
It could happen.
Science.
Dinosaurs. Saw one yesterday.
Did you get lost? She couldn't buy into Chris Pratt.
Is this Bryce Dallas Howard you're talking about now?
No.
Oh, your sister.
could you? See, I thought of him as like the reluctant trainer who doesn't believe in the politics but wants to live with the dinosaurs.
He cares about the animals. The way I looked at it and the way I think I put it in my review is he's the one that cares about, he sees the dinosaurs as animals, the smart animals, intelligent animals. The Bryce Dallas Howard character, who kind of runs the place, sees the dinosaurs as a job.
Mm.
The military contractor sees the dinosaurs as a weapon. So they all have these, you know, and the rich guy sees them as an investment, the guy who owns the place. And of course, you know, if you own a place like that, you're going to meet a really bad end in this kind of movie.
Spoiler.
Yes, exactly. It's not even a spoiler, though,
at this
point.
No, it's pretty
predictable.
It's
kind of a given.
You know, the rich guy is just, you know, not going to fare very well in a movie like this. What was the question?
No, the actor, Chris Pratt, was he believable as like the John Wayne of dinosaurs?
Yeah, sure. You know, I like Chris Pratt. I find him, he's got this kind of jocular.
He's good charisma.
Yeah, he's got this kind of goofy, jocular action hero thing going. And, you know, I really enjoyed him in Guardians of the Galaxy.
Me too, yeah.
And I thought he was fine in this. You know, is the character believable? Is the dinosaur whisperer, is that something that you might encounter in your daily life? No, of course not. But the character worked for me in the context of the movie.
Okay. Well,
what about Bryce Dallas Howard? I mentioned her earlier. Every preview I've seen, she's running around in like a perfect bob and high heels in the park.
She makes it through. So I have a beef with this.
Yeah.
She makes it through the whole movie, running from dinosaurs, wading through mud and grass, and you see in the last scene, she's still wearing her high heels.
She doesn't kick them off because she kind of does that big production of like making herself, you know, sort of fixing her wardrobe to be an action hero. And there's a lot.
Right.
I should say there's a lot of nodding and winking in this movie.
Yeah, I loved how self-aware it was. It was very.
You know, it's looking back both at the original Jurassic Park and also just this genre.
You didn't think that was too much over the top when they're in the lab and then they almost repeat the same scene from the first movie?
It's been so long since I've seen the first movie. And plus the guy, you know, one of the guys who's working in the lab, played by Jake Johnson, is wearing a Jurassic Park t-shirt.
Yeah.
And he talks about how he got it on eBay for $150. And, you know, he's talking about the actual park, but he could be talking about the movie itself.
He has the best scene in the whole movie, though, and he's, you know, the woman that works next to him is getting ready to leave, and he's like, this huge dramatic music is playing, and he runs up and he's gonna kiss her, and she's like,
I have a boyfriend.
Yes, that was awesome. Chris Wynn, what can you tell us about this Jurassic World app? Is it awesome, or are all the kids digging it?
So I didn't make it to the movie, but I did get the app, which the movie makers are pushing pretty hot.
That's
heavy.
Like the new, I didn't read the book, but I saw the movie. I didn't see the movie, but I got the app.
I totally downloaded the app. So it's a mobile movie app, and it's actually pretty fun. You pick your dinosaur. Options include the Aptostride, the Indominus Rex.
But you shouldn't pick that one. This is what we learned.
Asterisk, not a real dinosaur.
Really? Aptocall, I can't keep up with them. But you basically pick a dinosaur, and then it allows you to take a picture, and you merge them all into a video. So you can create a video of yourself being chased by your dinosaur of choice. And then, of course, they hope you share it in social media and all that. So
this, I'm giving it thumbs down.
Will you be using this app frequently in your daily routine?
I will do this. I will try it out, and I will post the result on our show page.
Okay.
So you guys can go check it out later.
Me and Chris fighting over. Yeah, we're gonna running from the dinosaurs.
So listeners, we're gonna unleash some dinosaurs on Chris and Lauren, and then I will post the result on our show page. So check it out.
I can't wait. As you may have heard, Jurassic World opens nationwide this Friday. You can read my review at guidelive.com. I gave it a B+. Spoiler alert, we'll be right back. So let's move on to our touts. This is the portion of the show where each of us recommends one thing we are reading, watching, clicking on, listening to, or just plain obsessed with, perhaps even eating. We're going to start with our special guests first. Leslie Brenner, what would you like to tout?
I'd like to tout a restaurant in Fort Worth called Campestre Chula Vista, which is only open Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And they have on Sunday afternoons, I think from 11 to 3, they have an all-you-can-eat brunch on this spectacularly gorgeous patio. And it's very homey, wonderful cooking and killer drinks and just family-friendly and a whole lot of fun.
Sounds good. Alfredo.
I don't know if I'm doing this the right way or not, but you just told me like 5 minutes ago, and in terms
there's
of
there's no wrong way
just
to
jump
shout.
In, man.
Okay,
it's just a podcast.
There's a new CD that came out yesterday by this band that I really like a lot, Of Monsters and Men.
Oh yeah, I love
from
them.
Iceland. It's really good. Their first title CD was great. This one is really good. So I'm enjoying that right now.
Of Monsters and Men. Mark Lamster, what would you like to tout this week?
Well, I'm going to tout a book by an architect named Brantley Hightower, which is a very NBA name. And the book is...
I don't know about the Brantley part, but the Hightower part.
Hightower,
certainly
sure.
Is.
So he's written a wonderful book called The Courthouses of Central Texas. I'm a bit of an obsessive with the courthouses of Texas. I think they're one of the most fascinating...
Who isn't, though?
Yeah.
You should check out your Instagram feed. It's a fascinating source for photos of those and other things, actually, from around the state.
Yeah, and Hightower this is basically a typological study of these courthouses, traces their evolution, the different styles, how they progressed, what they've meant for their communities, what they've meant for their urban form. And the photographs are beautiful, and what's really exceptional is these drawings he's made of them. Beautiful, beautiful renderings, and then he's done some very interesting layerings of these drawings that allow you to see the different scales and the growth of them, and do a lot of interesting comparisons between them. It's a really, really fascinating book. So, Brantley Hightower, The Courthouses of Central Texas, University of Texas Press, really wonderful book.
Chris Wynn.
Leslie Brenner, cover your ears, because I'm going to give the anti-Mexican food tout. Talking about Tex-Mex and things covered in ooey-gooey blankets of cheese, Ojeda's on Maple Avenue.
Oh, yeah. I love Ojeda's.
I do too. I mean, they have my favorite mole.
You like
the
salsa, right?
Actually.
The salsa is amazing. The big blanketed cheesy dishes. I will say I actually get sometimes I get the skinny enchiladas. You know, they're like mushroom enchiladas without the sauce, and there's like salad.
Those are not enchiladas, though.
It's not the real.
That sounds gross.
It's chicken and tortilla, totally separated.
I love the, it's good. I mean, the margaritas, it's Kool-Aid with just the hardest, cheapest alcohol they can mix with it.
From the old machine, right? You have to ask for the one from the old machine.
Yes. But it's comfort food to me. I love it. It's just a great, I mean, it was good enough for Bill Clinton, you know. I'm just saying.
Does the old machine have like margarita resin on it or something?
Gross. So when you're, Lauren. You know, drunk and exhausted from stuffing your food and stuff food into your belly,
right.
I binge watched over the weekend. I haven't actually finished it yet, but the Amazon series Transparent, which mm-hmm. feels particularly relevant in the last few weeks, and it's really beautiful. I mean, it's heartbreaking. And just this lovely story of how a family deals with secrets when they kind of come out. And I loved it.
And it has the great Jeffrey Tambor.
It does, and he's fabulous.
And the starring role.
Yeah.
I need to catch up with that.
Yeah, two different people have mentioned that to me just this week, so I have to make time and see that.
And we're all behind.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
My tout is a novel. It's called The Moore's Account. It's by Leila Lalami. I hope I'm pronouncing your name right, Leila. It was one of the Pulitzer finalists for fiction. It's the story of Esteban, who is the first known African-American slave. He came over with the Spanish to try to find La Florida, basically the new
Florida.
And it's a great book. It's essentially taking these colonial stories that we've read historically and putting a very post-colonial twist on it. Mm-hmm. And it's written from the perspective and written in the beautiful voice of Esteban, the slave, sort of watching as these Spaniards come into the New World and just alienate everybody and do a lot of bad things.
Right.
Fantastic book. It's beautifully written. It's called The Moor's Account. You'll find links to some of the things we've talked about today on our show page at guidelive.com, the entertainment website of the Dallas Morning News. Drop us an email at mixedmedia@dallasnews.com or send us a tweet at @mixedmediapod. Look for us soon in the iTunes store where you can subscribe to the show. Mixed Media is engineered by Brian Elledge and produced by Christopher Wynn. We'll be back next week with a special summer vacation edition of the podcast. Until then, for Christopher Wynn and Lauren Smart, I'm Chris Wagner. Thanks for listening.